Morning. How are you? Quiet. Everybody was quiet last time, too. Good. Well, as you may recall from a couple of weeks ago, we've started a look at the book of Exodus. And we're approaching it. I already said this once before, but some folks weren't here. We'll approach it a little differently than what we sometimes do, we've done lately, like in Romans, where we've gone verse by verse and picked it apart diligently. This time, we're going to take more of a broad historical view. We'll read a chapter at a time or a section at a time and get a kind of a broader picture of the history of what's going on during the times of the Exodus. So a slightly different approach. It is a historical book, so I think that's an appropriate approach to the book of Exodus. But today, we're on Exodus chapter 2. As I say, I'll read it right now. We'll have a word of prayer, and then we'll get to looking at what was going on during Exodus chapter 2. It says, "And there was went a man of the house of Levi, and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein. And she laid it in the flags at the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off, to wit which would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself in the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew and brought him And she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, because I drew him out of the water. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren, and looked on their burdens. And he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way. And when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said to them that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killedst the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, and Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, how is it that ye are come so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, and where is he? Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. And she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom. For he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. And it came to pass, in process of time, that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of their bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Let's have a bit of prayer. Lord, we thank you for this day. First day of July, a new month. We ask that you'll bless this month, that you'll make it profitable toward your glory, can't help but think of what Brother Wilbrandt was talking about last Sunday about it should all be toward your glory, everything we do. We ask that your name will be glorified in this Sunday school time today. We do ask that you'll comfort those folk in Nigeria. There's been an awful lot of persecution going on over there. Bless them. It's in your name I pray. Amen. So in last chapter, chapter 1 of Exodus, we saw the necessity for God to deliver the Hebrews from Egypt. Remember, God had made promises to the children of Israel. He'd said, you're going to dwell in the promised land. Well, here they are. They're a numerous people. That part of the promise was fulfilled. There's all kinds of them now. But they're under bondage in Egypt. So God has to deliver them, or God loses face. God's made a promise. He can't keep the promise. God loses face. So God needs to deliver the Hebrews from Egypt. Now we're going to begin to see the means that God's going to use. It's going to take time, but we're going to begin to see the means. And the means is a Hebrew couple we're introduced to right here. A Hebrew couple of the tribe of Levi. Verse 1 says, there was a man of the house of Levi, and he took to wife a daughter of Levi. That's where it starts. Did you know that God never starts a plan with a program? He always starts with a person. Always, every single time. You can mark it down. We saw Noah. That was God's plan to save mankind from sin. We saw Abraham. That was God's plan to save his people out of the world. We saw Joseph save God's people again in Genesis. And we're going to see more as we move forward. In this case, it's two people from the tribe of Levi. Now, ultimately, the one person where everything's going to come together is Jesus. God always uses a person. God always uses human beings to bring together the plan that he's had all along. He doesn't use a program, he uses people. Now, I find it interesting that all of mankind's problems began with a single couple as well, didn't it? All of mankind's problems began with that single couple back in Genesis. And now we're going to see this deliverance begin with a single couple as well. It's amazing to me how often God uses a man and wife to accomplish his plans. When you really start to look at the Bible, you see a man and wife accomplishing God's plans. When God looks for a cross-section of humanity, he quite often looks at a man and wife. Mark it down, you go through your Bible, you're going to see that quite a lot. Now, notice here that we're not given their names. We will get them in chapter 6. We have to wait till chapter 6 to get their names. But for now, Moses is just giving us the basic necessary information for the story. There was a man and wife. They were Levites. They had a son. We are told what tribe they come from. We're not given their names, but we are told what tribe they come from. And that gives us a suggestion. That tells us quite a few things, actually, if you look into the history of the tribe of Levi. We'll talk a little bit about some of that, right? We'll talk about some of it now. We'll talk about some of it in a little bit. But it suggests to me that Moses is to be a mediator for his people. That, after all, was one of the roles of the tribe of Levi. They were the mediators. When Moses and Aaron initiate the priesthood, they stood as mediators between God and man. We're going to see that later on in the book of Exodus. Moses is a mediator between God and God's people all his life. This is where it begins, with his mother and father. Now, not only does God always use people to accomplish his plan, God seems to prefer to use unlikely people as well. When he looks around for who am I going to use to do this, he always seems to choose the most unlikely person he can find. That's one of the things my God does. I don't know why. I got to ask him later. But that seems to be one of the things he does. We get a clue into that. You know, it's a familiar passage. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul saw this, noticed the same thing that I've noticed. Paul's talking to the Corinthian people as they look out in their church. And they might be wondering, how come we've got these folks? How come we've got the folks that we do have? 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 26, and for a few verses following, it says, "For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and base things of the world, and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are. Why? That no flesh should glory in his presence." God gets all the glory. No flesh is going to glory in God's presence. That's why. God uses the weak and he uses the unlikely so that nobody can say that they ever accomplished anything in their own strength. Human power, human pride, and human ambition can never accomplish any true deliverance. All they will do is bring more slavery to the same power, the same pride, and the same ambitions. When you start to develop and you start working in your own pride and your own power, you're just going to become a slave to get more pride and more power. That's how it works. So Moses is a very unlikely deliverer. Let's take a look at Moses here for a minute. He's a Hebrew baby. He's supposed to be drowned in the Nile River. Remember that from last chapter? That was the protocol. Pharaoh had made a declaration, any Hebrew boys that you find, take them down to the river and drown them. Well, here he is. He's got that death sentence over his head. And he, little three-month-old baby, supposed to be drowned in the Nile, is pitted against the most powerful man on earth. Not good odds. I wouldn't bet those odds. But Moses' mother and father saw that he was a goodly child. That's what it says. Goodly child. Hebrew word goodly, that's tob. And it literally means favored. He was a favored child. And his parents chose to hide Moses for 3 months until he was in safe hands. Now that's an act of faith that God chose to record forever in Hebrews chapter 11. When he talks about the great faithful things that God's people have done in the past, let's turn over to Hebrews 11, 23. This is one God remembered. You want to see a powerful act of faith that's worth singling out in human history, God says? Hebrews 11, verse 23, it says, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment." God thought that's worth writing down. Out of all of human history, they saved a baby safe from Pharaoh for 3 months. That may not be one of the ones I would have picked, but that's one God picked. Now, I got to make a little bit of an aside here. Every parent thinks their child is goodly, right? I mean, every parent that looks at their baby, three-month-old baby, oh, what a goodly child. The fact is, just about every baby looks like Winston Churchill, but not in the eyes of their parents. Not in the eyes of their parents. So, Moses' mother builds him an ark, which automatically makes me think of Noah. Doesn't it? And that ark is placed amongst the flags or the reeds in the, we hear about papyrus. These are papyrus reeds. That's what we're talking about. In the shallows where the current's going to be very slight. Otherwise, he's going to be swept out to sea. This was also important because this is where the women of the palace might see it when they come down to bathe in the Nile. Now, I got to say here at this point, this is part of a worship service to the Nile god. This isn't just taking a bath. This is worship service. I'll get to that in just a minute. But let me make one more interjection here. Notice again that it's the bottom of the power scale that rescued baby Moses this time, too. Three women. Admittedly, one of them is the daughter of Pharaoh, but the daughter of Pharaoh and two maidservants. Now, here's where I'm going to tell you something else. I'm certain that this was not just a chance happening. Oh, let's just stick him in the reeds and see what happens. That's not what it was. I think Moses' mother had this plan to happen exactly like this all along. And here's why. Let's talk about Pharaoh's daughter. Here's one of the things that women of the court of the Pharaoh in those days would have to do. She didn't just bathe anywhere. This is not just an ordinary, this is my morning bath. No. And she certainly would not do that in public view. That's one reason I know that. How many people just, oh, I'm going to go down to the, and I'm going to take a bath in front of everyone. No, this is something specifically done in front of everyone. Why? This was part of a regularly scheduled worship service to the god of the Nile named Hapi. By the way, the fertility god. We talked about that last time. And remember the apparent paradox of drowning the Hebrew babies in the fertility god of Egypt. Anyway, this was a regularly scheduled worship service, and this is how Moses' mother knew exactly where and when to leave the baby. You can't leave a three-month-old baby that long by themselves. You need to have a specific time when I'm going to stick this baby into the reeds. We know when this regularly scheduled worship service happens. Just before that, we're going to slip the baby into here. That when they come down, they're going to see it and think, hey, the God gave us something. So when she opens the basket, she can tell right away this is a Hebrew baby because he's circumcised. It's easy to tell. And strangely, she adopts the boy as her own son right then and there. And selects his own mother to be his wet nurse, but I'm kind of jumping the gun here. But do you see God's hand at work here? Moses, in Egyptian, Moses is actually not a Hebrew name. It's been adopted by the Hebrews now, and it's a very common name, Moshe. You've heard of Moshe Dayan. He's Moses. But Moses is actually originally an Egyptian name, and it means to be drawn out. We're later going to see that Moses draws his own people out through the water too. Just as he was drawn out of the water, he will draw the Hebrew people through the Red Sea as well. But isn't it interesting that Pharaoh's daughter, not for a moment, seems to have even thought about obeying her father's command to drown this baby? It was her father that issued the command, when you find a Hebrew baby, drown him. Here's a Hebrew baby. Here we are in the Nile. What a convenient place. It's like God sent this baby for me to drown, just like my father commanded. She doesn't seem to consider that obedience to that command for a second. Now, it could be her motherly way. As soon as she, the Bible does say that as soon as she heard him cry, she had compassion on him. She cracked like an egg. I'm not going to make any further comment on that. But Moses' older sister comes running over and offers to find a wet nurse for him. Now, here's another thing I can't help but think about. I feel like Columbo here. Think with me for a minute. If any significant number of Hebrew babies had been killed here, doesn't it seem reasonable that there would be a fair number of Hebrew women candidates for wet nurse for Pharaoh's? Pharaoh's daughter should not have had any problem finding a wet nurse if any number of Hebrew male children had been killed. This leads me to believe that Pharaoh's command was not carried out. I don't believe very many Hebrew boys were killed. Otherwise, she wouldn't have had a hard time at all finding a wet nurse. But logistics aside, notice the irony that not only did God save Moses, but he had his own mother paid by Pharaoh to nurse him. And I think there's irony there. My God takes care of every little detail, doesn't he? Above and beyond what you could ask or think. So Moses grows up, and he's educated by the Egyptians. By the way, the Egyptians were the most sophisticated, most scientific people of the day. So he receives his training from the hands of his oppressors, the very people who were supposed to kill him. He now gets raised and trained, educated. Now, what's a potential Pharaoh taught? I mean, here he is. He's the son of Pharaoh's daughter. What is a potential? He's in the line for the kingdom. What would he be taught? Yeah, how to lead people. How to lead people. How do you lead a nation? I don't know how to lead a nation. There's a lot to it. My God knows exactly how to work a plan, doesn't he? Now, verse 11 says that by the time he was grown, Moses knew the truth about his origins. He knew he wasn't Egyptian. So he goes down to the work area and checks on conditions down there to see how the Hebrews are doing. He knows that they're slaves. He knows that they're working. Let's go see what the conditions are. I can't do much about changing the protocol, what the edict is, but I can at least check up on the conditions. So while he's there, he sees an Egyptian hitting a Hebrew. So Moses' temper flies, and he kills him, buries him right on the spot. By the way, this is consistent with the tribe of Levi. When we saw Levi back in Genesis, we saw that they wiped out all of the people who raped their sister. The tribe of Levi is a passionate, very hot-tempered tribe. But this is also a running theme that we're going to see in Exodus of Moses' hot temper. Remember Moses. Here he kills a man. Just kills him and buries him right there. Later on, he's going to strike the rock that he was told to speak to. He's going to smash the tablets that God had just carved out of stone for him. But besides his hot temper, we see one other thing right here in this. We also see a very strong sense of justice, don't we? And that's a running theme with Moses as well. We're going to see a running sense of strong sense of justice. Notice something else. Moses here failed to deliver his people. He sees them being oppressed by an Egyptian. Good opportunity. I can deliver them right now. Why don't I start right now? I'll kill this guy. They'll follow me. Why did he fail this time? Think with me. Why would he fail this time? Yep. I'll take it. Bruce? Yeah. I'm going to work. You both of you are right. You're both right. I'm going to word it just a slightly different. He's trying to do it in his own strength. He's trying to do it in his own strength. It's saying the same thing you guys are saying. You see, you will never be successful at anything unless you seek the Lord's help and his guidance first. So now Pharaoh wants to kill Moses. Now this Pharaoh would have grown up with Moses. And the murder of a slave master by a member of the royal family might be scandalous, but in those days it really wasn't worthy of a death penalty. I mean, it's not death penalty worthy. Now it's likely, remember this is the Pharaoh that grew up with Moses, it's likely that he wanted to kill Moses because he felt threatened by him. Exactly. He was jealous of him. I mean, here's another candidate for the throne. The old man's not getting any younger. One of us is going to be the next one on the throne, and there can only be one.
But that doesn't seem very controversial. Even the neighbor, my wives, weren't killing the baby, because they made excuses that they, and yet they were saved, so were the boys, because he got them
alone. Exactly. Exactly. My God is faithful. My God is faithful. That's the theme throughout the book of Exodus, is God is faithful. When he says something's going to happen, it is going to happen. You can take it to the bank. It's rock-ribbed. So, anyway, Pharaoh threatens Moses, threatens to kill him. So Moses runs away to the land of Midian, which would be modern Saudi Arabia. He runs away to Saudi Arabia. Now, Acts chapter 7 and verse 30 says that he was away for quite a long time.
It's quite a story, so much. We're missing a lot. I don't know if you're doing it on purpose.
Exactly. I'm trying to give a broad...
Because the broad story is, let's go a little further back, okay, before he went.
Mm-hmm.
When he went, he was about 40 years old.
About 40 years old.
He learned all about their sun gods and everything.
That's exactly right.
So when he gets ready to bring his people out, he's got it.
Exactly.
Now that's the part I didn't hear yet.
Well, that's the next point I'm getting to right here. God sent him away to Midian. We see in Acts that it was for a long time, 40 years exactly. Yeah. I'm jumping the gun a little bit. He's 40 years old right now. God needs to send him to Midian, the middle of nowhere, to get him to the end of himself. Yes. That's right. So he wasn't a young man when he comes back. It's a lot of years. I'm not that good at math.
Yeah, well, just think, Dad's almost there. 40 years.
Almost. Yeah, very close, yeah. Yeah.
You get an idea where Moses was.
That's right. Before he starts a new career.
Right.
Any case. Jim was just saying, okay, we got 140 at the beginning of his life, and we got another 40. Sam, what's that? 80, you're right. So that would make Moses 80 when God is finally ready to use him. And then he uses him for another 40. But that's, we're jumping the gun again. God could not use the confident young Egyptian, best education, most powerful man on earth, second in line for the Pharaoh. God couldn't use that guy. He needs to use an old Midianite shepherd. Now, all of that training that he got earlier in his days, that all came back. He didn't lose that, but he needed to come to the end of himself in Midian. That's why he was there. That's why he was 40 years as a shepherd in nowhere. He was a shepherd in the middle of nowhere land. Like Jacob before him, Moses is a fugitive from justice. He's not financially able to get married, so he has to become the adopted son of his father-in-law. Calls him Raluel here. Next chapter we're going to see he's called Jethro. Two names is not uncommon in the Middle East. There's no contradiction in your Bible. This sort of arrangement here was fairly common in those days. We already saw it with Jacob when he partnered with Laban. He really became Laban's adopted son and married his two daughters. That's not, even in this day and age in the Middle East, that's not uncommon. Notice that although Moses has a home and a family, he's been here for quite a while now, he still names his son Gershom, which means stranger. He's been here for a while. He's a shepherd. He's got a job, new career. He's working for his father-in-law. Moses never lost his identity as an Israelite, don't you see? Even after 40 years, Moses never really adopted the local culture. He never became a Midianite. His father-in-law was the priest of Midian, it says. Moses never got sucked into that. Moses remained a Hebrew. Now, from a human standpoint, verse 22 is kind of a dead end, isn't it? She bare him a son, called his name Gershom, for he said, I've been a stranger in a strange land. That's kind of a dead end. Moses is a vagabond from home. He's got nothing. He's married, got a son. He lives in the middle of nowhere. He's a shepherd. He's a nobody. He went from, wow, it's a riches to rags story. He tried to deliver his people. He failed. Now he's a fugitive from justice. But in God's mind, the story is just getting started. God can finally use this man, and that's what we're going to start seeing next chapter. So the old Pharaoh dies, it says here. The old Pharaoh dies and a new one's crowned. But there's no relief for the Israelites. You see that in the last several verses? They're still enslaved and they cry out to God for deliverance. And God hears their cry. And he remembers them, it says. Now this is a kind of a way of saying that God's time is now right. He's going to return Moses to Egypt. And he's going to send him as an answer to their prayers. You know what? The Israelites are sitting there and they're praying for deliverance and God hears them and his answer is a person. I said that in the beginning. It always is. The answer is a person. It's Moses this time. Now, did you know that God always has an answer ready for when His people cry out to Him? I mean when His people really cry out to Him. When His people really bend their knee and humbly petition Him and ask, God always has an answer. My God is always ready to hear our cry. But we so rarely cry out on a real issue. We get so sidetracked with piddly, trivial things, don't we? When God really wants to work on something big, God wants to show Himself powerful, wants to show Himself glorious, but we so rarely ask for anything worthy of our God. You mind if I ask some big things of God right now? I'm done. Lord, You are a mighty God.